Hello, this is Janice Schweizer with the Pantograph for Tuesday, April 7th, 2026. We begin on the front page with Uptown Normal, Museum debuts new experience. Families excited to preview new farm and health exhibit by Olivia Jacobs. Kids and their families were excited Monday morning when Children's Discovery Museum in Uptown Normal previewed its brand new exhibit, quote, From the Farm to a Healthy Me, unquote, to members. It's the museum. It's just a great place for the kids to come and enjoy. They can just be kids, said Sharon Sturgill of Bloomington, who brought her five-year-old twin grandsons, Mac and Miles, to the preview. Yeah, they love it. Sturgill, whose family has been museum members of 7 years, said the boys have been looking forward to the big floor reopening and were excited to see everything, especially the tractors and the animals. They had also enjoyed the new climbing areas and the interactive pet MRI simulator, she said. Mac told the Pantograph he enjoyed playing with his brother and climbing and crawling in the area that emulated honeycombs in the new toddler area. Miles said he liked the tractor and the animals, as well as the taco truck and large pumpkin. His grandma said the museum is Miles' favorite place to go, and he would come back every day if he could. Beth Wisman, executive director, said museum leadership conducted a feasibility study as part of developing the museum's master plan to evaluate what upgrades visitors really wanted to see and what they could execute. This included moving the original Healthy Me exhibit, which opened in 2021, from the first floor to the second. Wisman said much of the exhibit needed to be updated anyway, and creating a new exhibit allowed designers to include more connections between agriculture and nutrition. We talk a lot about building great exhibits, and it takes a community to do that, Wisman said. We turned to our local agriculture when we first started doing our think tank, our roundtable, because this exhibit needs to be here for 15 to 20 years. They were challenged to use this exhibit as a way to tell a story in a way that is sustainable for several years. How do we build it in a way that we can update it as we go? The executive director said. Just really thinking about supporting a museum and thinking about us as a resource for families and schools, and just making sure that our community sees us as a value and something that's worthy investing in. Wisman said this is the biggest update to the museum has done to the space since it opened in Uptown Normal more than 20 years ago. And since its members invest in the museum, staff decided a long time ago that members should be the first to experience new exhibits before they are open to the public, giving them a more personal experience, she said. Wisman said Monday morning she was expecting around 1,000 members to visit the Children's Discovery Museum throughout the day to see the new exhibit. The new second floor exhibit replaces the former Ag-Amazing exhibit, which opened in 2006. The new space was made possible by donations from the McLean County Farm Bureau, Compeer Financial, and other community partners, as well as the fundraising committee led by Larry and Marlene Dietz and Julie and Bob Dobsky. So what's new is really a whole new experience, Wisman said. Kids are going to immediately notice things like the tractor is new, but they'll also see the Ag Lab, which is a deep dive into technology and storytelling that will show kids what modern agriculture looks like. But we have some old favorites. The combine has been upgraded, but it is the original. Our cows have stayed with us, but there is a brand new pizza kitchen and a brand new grocery store, which is a big upgrade from our last tiny space. In addition to the Ag Lab, new combine, and John Deere tractor, there are also two different interactive drone activities highlighting technology in ag, hand-sculpted pigs, cows, and chickens with real-life texture and character, as well as a vet and animal care center. A ball drop maze representing the journey grain takes from the field to trucks and grain elevators, a kid-sized food truck with seasonal menus, and a new toddler space focusing on Illinois' specialty crops and pollinators with a crawl-through design and watering can slide. Tori Bogard of Bloomington brought her three kids, Connor 5, Skylar 3, and Piper 1, to Monday's preview. Bogard said they've been members since her oldest was 2 years old, and they typically come a few times a month. She said she likes that the museum is open pretty much all the time, and it offers a good opportunity to get out of the house and have the kids engaged, especially during the winter. Connor asked to go do something Monday morning, and when she saw the museum was hosting a preview, they were excited to see what the new exhibit had in store. "I think the kids are probably most excited about the new farm stuff. My kids have spent the most time in the new ball wall. Super engaging for the older one," she said. She said she was glad they were able to attend the preview because once they reopened it, "I figure it's going to be flooded with people. Even just for opening time, this is really busy for the museum." She and her kids liked seeing all the new offerings. "It's always fun to have new things," Beauregard said. Connor liked the tractor the best and said he was glad the museum got more fun stuff as he was looking through the microscope in the ag lab. A public grand opening for the exhibit is planned for Thursday, April 9th, with doors opening at 3 o'clock p.m. and a ribbon cutting set for 4 p.m. Wissman expects around 1,500 to 2,000 people to attend. "Those first looks when the kids come through the door and they see the thing that they want to see, like they're looking for the cows, they're still here. They're looking for the tractor, it's brand new. And then the new animals. That look on their face when they open the door and they run in is what I look forward to," she said. Drew Zimmerman writes, "ISU workers may strike. 300 AFSCME asked me members to walk Wednesday, if no deal on Tuesday. More than 300 Illinois State University employees, represented by AFSCME Local 1110, are prepared to strike on Wednesday if an agreement is not reached during a Tuesday morning mediation session with school administrators," unions leaders said on Monday. Last month, the union voted to authorize a strike with 97% of members voting in favor. A 10-day notice, effective Wednesday, April 8th, was then delivered to ISU President Andover Tarhouli. "Nobody wants to strike, but we're willing to do what it takes to achieve a contract with fair pay that respects the work we do," Chuck Carver, Local 1110 President, said in a news release. "We'll be in negotiations tomorrow morning, ready to stay as long as it takes to get an agreement, but that will require the administration to change its approach." The union, which is composed of employees who work in ISU's buildings, grounds, and dining centers, have been without a contract for nearly a year and without a pay increase for nearly 2 years. Pay for many employees begins at $16.60 an hour, and most make less than the living wage standard for a single adult, union leaders have said. ISU employees will hold a rally at 3:30 p.m. Tuesday to encourage support for a fair contract. Attendees will meet at the intersection of Mulberry Street, College Avenue, and School Street. Union representatives will be joined by State Senator David Kohler, State Representative Sharon Chung, Illinois AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer Pat Devaney, AFSCME Council 31 Deputy Director Mike Newman, and other leaders. As of March 17th, Local 1110 had held 26 negotiation sessions and 3 mediation sessions with the federal mediator. At the time, the university stated it has worked and will continue to work to reach a fair and fiscally responsible contract agreement that addresses concerns raised by AFSCME. The university provided the same statement after the union announced Monday it was prepared to strike. Olivia Jacobs writes, ISU Professor, AI Education Fellow. An Illinois State University professor has been selected to join the inaugural cohort in an AI Education Fellowship. The Computing Research Association announced Elahi Javadi, Associate Professor of Information Systems, is joining 25 others as an AI Education Fellow in the National Science Foundation's National Artificial Intelligence Research Resource Program. As part of the fellowship, Javadi serves as a National Ambassador for Advancing AI Education through the program's pilot classroom and its pilot classroom expansion, AI Education Research Coordination Network. She currently serves as chair of the school's IT's curriculum committee and co-chairs the AI Education Mini-Track at the Americas Conference on Information Systems. Dr. Javadi is a respected faculty member and leader in her field, bringing over a decade of experience in curriculum development, said Sharif Rashad, director of the School of Information Technology at ISU, in a news release. She maintains a consistent record of collaborating with student organizations, schools in Central Illinois, and community partners, such as libraries and museums, to expand access to AI education. I congratulate her on this appointment and appreciate her influence is being recognized by CRA as a faculty leader advancing undergraduate AI education and expanding access to AI teaching resources nationwide. The cohort represents 23 states across the U.S. and spans public and private universities, community colleges, and other higher education settings. Together, they will help expand access to high-quality AI education resources and foster a national community of practice focused on effective AI teaching, according to a news release from the university. The fellowship, led by the Computing Research Association, is funded by the National Science Foundation. Chosen fellows will help start and adapt courses using resources from the pilot classroom, support faculty nationwide in integrating materials into courses, and help shape the direction of the National AI Research Resource Program. The fellowship term began in March and will continue through February 2027. It includes $5,000 as a stipend and national visibility for the fellows as AI education leaders. Fellows will also lead monthly seminars, participate in strategic work meetings, and champion the adoption of AI education resources on their campuses and beyond, according to the news release. Caitlin Klepek writes, Homicide Investigation, WGN, revisits 1993 killing of ISU student Lockmiller. WGN in Chicago is shining a spotlight on Normal and the 1993 unsolved homicide of Jennifer Lockmiller, unveiling new information and never-before-seen interviews. Who Killed Jennifer will debut April 7th on the free WGN Plus app and air at 9:30 p.m. Wednesday, April 22nd on WGN TV. Jennifer Lockmiller was a 22-year-old Illinois State University student from Decatur. She was found dead in her Normal apartment in August 1993. Investigators said she was strangled with the cord of an alarm clock and stabbed in the chest with scissors. It's a powerful story with a powerful lesson, said Andrew Schroeter, investigative producer for the WGN documentary. It can happen to anyone, anywhere, at any time. Schroeder and a team of investigators from WGN, including anchor Larry Potash and photojournalist Mike D'Angelo, say they have uncovered new information about the Normal Police Department's investigation into her death. The TV station has been working on the special for the last year or so, Schroeder said, noting interest spiked after they learned Illinois had been called the wrongful conviction capital of the world. Lockmiller's ex-boyfriend, Alan Beeman, was convicted of murder in her death and served 13 years in prison before the conviction was overturned. Beeman and his exoneration team have said no physical evidence linked him to the crime, and he was 140 miles away in his hometown of Rockford at the time of her death. Beeman summed it up best when he said, "None of it was justice," Schroeder said. "There is no closure." The case remains unsolved, and many lives have been affected by Locke Miller's death, the producer said. For the 30-minute special, the WGN crew interviewed 24 people, including family, friends, investigators, and people who are linked to Locke Miller's story who have never spoken publicly before. Everyone involved has been changed. It's had a lasting impact, he said. Schroeder said he and his team are proud to put the story forward, noting WGN-TV has taken the time to flesh out and drill as deep as we could into this story. The station is also working on 2 follow-up productions, which cover the status of the Locke Miller case and key evidence that may have been overlooked. In addition to air on Chicago area televisions, Who Killed Jennifer is also expected to air on other Nexstar stations in Illinois. The special will be posted to YouTube and available for download as a podcast. Viewers can download the WGN Plus app on Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, and select Samsung Smart TVs. Watch the trailer for the special at WGNTV.com/WKJ. Now we'll look at Jerry Vogler's Veterans Corner. Q&A. Question. I separated from the Navy in 2002 after serving 13 years. I received about $25,000 separation pay due to a medical condition that caused my separation. I found out several years later that I should file a claim for VA service-connected disability for the same medical condition that resulted in my separation with disability compensation. I was never told that the $25,000 would have to be paid back. I filed the claim in 2015 and was rated at 60% disabled. I recently received a letter from the VA indicating that I must repay the $25,000 I received over 23 years ago. The explanation in the letter was not clear. Is this legit? The VA is stopping my VA service-connected compensation until the entire $25,000 is paid back. Answer. Yes, unfortunately, it is probably legit. Extradentary circumstances may overrule the law, but those cases are rare. Under the federal law, a veteran cannot receive both separation pay and VA disability compensation for the same period of service. When a veteran who previously received separation pay is later awarded disability compensation, the veteran is required to withhold this full monthly disability payment until the after-tax amount of the separation pay has been recovered. The VA is required to recover the amount of the separation pay no matter how long it has been since the separation pay was made. In the simplest term, the separation pay for the disability is supposed to provide income to the affected veteran until such time as the VA approves the veteran's VA service-connected disability claim. Since VA claims often take a considerable amount of time for approval, the original separation pay is usually deducted from the back pay award amount. Any residual amount still owed to recover the separation pay would be recovered by the reduction of the monthly disability compensation. Browse DOD Disability Separation Pay Deductions from VA Disability Compensation for more details. The Department of Defense classifies military discharges into several types. The main types are honorable, general under honorable conditions, other than honorable conditions, and bad conduct discharges and dishonorable discharges, with each affecting eligibility for benefits and future employment differently. The scuttlebutt about requesting and receiving a discharge upgrade is very discouraging if all you consider is the opinions of fellow veterans. Most veterans do not follow the Defense Department information that is available online, and keep in mind your military days where rumors went flying around only to find out that the rumor mongers knew no more than you did, when the story actually was affirmed or denied. To use the vernacular language, quote, the latrine lawyers rarely ever knew what was going on, close quote. The Department of Defense provides quarterly data on discharge review boards and boards for correction of military naval records, including case outcomes by service branch. The Army reported for April through June of 2024 that they approved 65% of the requests for upgrade. The Navy approved 33% and the Air Force 15.7% of the requests for upgrade for cases involving mental health-related discharges. In cases involving sexual assault, the Army approved 17 of 18 requests, the Navy 11 of 41, and the Air Force 2 of 15. For requests involving other claims like procedural issues, the Army approved 81%, the Navy 58%, and the Air Force 44%. So, vets with bad paper discharges, see a Veterans Service Officer or an attorney who specializes in this type of action and find out if you just might be able to get that discharge you have always desired. Depending on how bad the bad paper discharge case was, the upgrade, if successful, could open the door to VA benefits that you have earned but have been denied. Your County Veterans Assistance Commission provides a wide variety of services for veterans who reside in McLean County. The McLean County VAC is accessible at mcleancountyill.gov/98/veterans-assistance and at mcleancountyvac.gov. Browse our website and contact us at 309-888-5140 to make an appointment or to contact VAC staff. The website is a work in progress, but already provides the basic information to establish a contact or to continue one. And the quote of the day is from Theodore Roosevelt. If you could kick the person in the pants responsible for most of your trouble, you wouldn't be able to sit for a month. Looking at the U.S. economy, we have dizzying markets drive gas prices, factors largely outside of gas stations' control, by Hannah Fingerhut with the AP. The near daily changes in U.S. gas prices are dizzying for drivers who are left feeling frustrated and cash-strapped by the highest fuel costs since 2022. With the Iran war pushing up prices worldwide, the U.S. average for a gallon of gas reached $4.09 on Friday, according to AAA. Prices can change from one day to the next or from one nearby station to another, forcing drivers in the U.S. to game out the right moment to fill up or hunt for cheaper prices. Experts say differences in price aren't typically decided by any individual gas retailer, and most of them aren't pocketing the extra pennies when prices rise. The uncertainty at the pump is trickling down from a massive, volatile oil and gas market that's making it hard for gas stations to keep up. Lonnie McWhirter, Director of Operations at 36 Lynn Refuel Station in South Minneapolis, said his margins have gotten much tighter. About a mile off Interstate 35, the neighborhood convenience store posted $3.399 a gallon for regular gas on Wednesday, which is about 18 cents lower than the metro average, according to AAA. We price based on what we're able to buy fuel at and how well we can operate, McWhirter said. He declined to speculate about his competitors, saying they've got different economics. Wholesale fuel prices, which shift multiple times a day, are the main reason McWhirter said he's charging more than a month ago. He's also facing higher credit card fees and rising costs to maintain pumps. In times like these, with consumers screaming for help, McWhirter said small operators like him act more on emotion than greed. We're in our stores every day looking our customers in the eye. It really takes a toll when people are having to cut back on certain things in order to afford to live. A lot of it is outside the gas retailer's control. Roughly half the price at the pumps pays for the cost of crude oil, the main ingredient in gasoline, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. About 20% goes to refiners who turn crude into gas. Those costs have risen as crude oil prices jumped in response to the war and shipping disruptions in the Strait of Hormuz. Gas retailers are adjusting the price at the pump to account for the higher price they just paid for their next shipment of gasoline. Taxes, federal, state, and local, account for nearly 20% of the price, while about 10% is left for retailers, who still have to pay for transportation, labor, and other expenses. Retailers' markup has averaged about 38 cents a gallon over the past 5 years, according to the Convenience Store Trade Group NACS, citing data from research firm OPIS. After expenses, stations may keep roughly 15 cents per gallon, said Jeff Lennard, vice president at NACS. Some make more, some make less. Patrick DeHaan, head of petroleum analysis at Gas Buddy, compared it to a homeowner's role in setting their sale price. If I was selling a house today, I'd be beholden to whatever the housing market is, DeHaan said. That's the same for gas station owners. Whatever the price of oil and gasoline are, they are a price taker, not a maker. Although national average just past $4 a gallon, the price that drivers pay varies widely by state, city, and station. Taxes alone can create large gaps. California's gas taxes and fees totaled about 71 cents per gallon last year, compared with roughly 9 cents in Alaska. Distance from refineries, the type of retailer, how much volume the location goes through, and whether there are other fuel options nearby also play a role. Gas stations near competitors may choose to price gasoline competitively on large outdoor signs to attract drivers, hoping they'll come inside and buy higher margin items, said Neil Walters, a partner focused on energy at the global management consulting firm Kearney. It's one of the only retail locations where you don't have to go into the store to find out what you're paying, Walters said. While U.S. retailers sell hundreds of millions of gallons of gas a day nationwide, they typically don't see large gains when prices rise. The margins shrink when the prices go up because it's harder for them to pass along the increases as quickly as they themselves get them, DeHaan said, who is from Gas Buddy. When oil prices start to fall, retailers may recover some of those losses, particularly if there's uncertainty about future supply costs. Prices can rocket up but tend to drift down like a falling feather, said Garrett Golding, Assistant VP for Energy Programs at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. Higher gas prices can also hurt sales inside the gas stations if customers who are being squeezed at the pump spend less on other things. So it's not always the case that higher prices mean the service station owners are actually doing better, Golding said. Most profits in the oil and gas supply chain are made upstream, he said, by companies that extract and refine crude oil. Still, Golding says they aren't necessarily celebrating. At some point, a significant spike in prices could start to hurt demand. And we'll do a Today in History. On this date, April 7th, in 1862, Union forces led by General Ulysses S. Grant and Major General Don Carlos Buell defeated Confederate forces at the Battle of Shiloh in Tennessee. In 1922, Interior Secretary Albert B. Fall signed a secret deal to lease U.S. Navy petroleum reserves in Wyoming and California to his friends, oilmen Harry F. Sinclair and Edward L. Doney, in exchange for cash gifts. Fall would eventually be sentenced to prison on bribery and conspiracy charges in what became known as the Teapot Dome Scandal. In 1954, President Dwight D. Eisenhower held a news conference in which he outlined the concept of the domino theory, as he spoke of the importance of containing the spread of communism in Indochina. In 1966, the U.S. Navy recovered a hydrogen bomb that the U.S. Air Force had lost in the Mediterranean Sea off Spain following a B-52 crash. And in 1984, the Census Bureau reported that L.A. had overtaken Chicago as the nation's second city in terms of population. And with that, we conclude the reading of Part 1 of the Pantograph for Tuesday, April 7th, 2026. I'm Janice Schweizer, and I will return shortly with part two.